Good morning, and thanks for tuning in to Community Conversations here on 88.5 KRFY. I'm today's host, Chris Bessler. We have a good show for you today that should be of interest to everyone for whom Lake Ponderé is an important part of living here. Today's discussion is about the proposed Rock Creek Mine that, if it proceeds, will be upstream of Lake Ponderé with potential impacts on the lake water quality. We speak with two individuals from the Rock Creek Alliance, Executive Director Mary Costello and Board Member John Edwards. The Rock Creek Alliance has been working to prevent or at minimum mitigate the potential effects of the mine for well more than 20 years, and we'll hear about the status of current litigation as well as the underlying issues with the mine. But first, a few words about this show. We air community conversations every Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. with recorded interviews on local issues. Plus, there's a podcast of each show that's available after airtime on our website at krfy.org. Community Conversations is actually just a stand-in for the live morning show that formerly aired at this time. We intend for the morning show to come back once we get past the coronavirus precautions that have closed our studio for live interviews. That, unfortunately, remains uncertain due to the rising cases here, but this is just to say that the morning show will be back someday. So with that, let's get on with today's interview about the Rock Creek Mine and the Rock Creek Alliance. Good morning. We're speaking now with Rock Creek Alliance Executive Director Mary Costello and John Edwards, member of the Board of Directors. Mary and John, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Appreciate it.
So we're going to be talking about the current status of some different litigation that the Rock Creek Alliance is currently involved in for folks that are up to speed on the work of the Rock Creek Alliance. But I think it's going to be most advantageous right now to talk about what the Rock Creek Alliance is about and the proposed Rock Creek Mine. The Rock Creek Alliance is actually one of the longest-lived local groups in Sandpoint that addresses environmental concerns. The issue for the Alliance is very specific, this proposed mine that's upstream of Lake Ponderé. And why don't we start right there, Mary? Tell us what the proposal for this mine is all about.
Sure, Chris. So this would be an underground copper-silver mine that would be constructed beneath the Cabinet Mountains Wilderness. And the project proposes to mine and process up to 10,000 tons of ore per day, basically 7 days a week for as long as 30 years. The problems inherent in the proposed mine are many, including a large tailings impoundment that would be 100 million tons of mine waste at the end of mining. There would be a perpetual discharge of heavy metals that would flow into the Clark Fork River and then on downstream into Lake Ponderé. There are issues with impacts to the wilderness. Obviously, if you have an industrial activity next to a wilderness, that is going to affect the recreational and aesthetic values of the wilderness. There are threatened species, grizzly bear and bull trout, that would be impacted from the mine. And again, I think of large concern to listeners in Sandpoint is that perpetual pollution and also the tailings impoundment that would be sitting right next to the Clark Fork River.
So
we have been addressing this. Go ahead.
Let's give the listeners a little better idea where specifically the mine would be located. This is upstream of Lake Ponderé, and it's right at the edge of the Cabinet Mountain Wilderness. Why don't you describe for listeners the specific location?
Well, it would be the Rock Creek drainage. So as you're traveling down Highway 200 heading east, it would be in the area between Noxon and Trout Creek, where the Rock Creek drainage is. And as I said, the impoundment would be right next to the river. It's about 25 miles from the Idaho border, and the mill site would be about 5 miles up the drainage, and the underground mine itself would be excavated beneath the Cabinet Mountains Wilderness.
And the let's talk about the mine first, and then let's talk about the tailings impoundment. The mine actually would go under the wilderness area, as I understand.
That's correct. Yes, they'd be accessing the ore from outside of the wilderness with a large tunnel that would be bored deep down into beneath the wilderness lands and lakes, which is one of the issues is potentially the impact to some of those overlying lakes once they excavate out the mine cavity.
There's a potential that the mine could actually dewater the lakes. Is that true?
Yes. Yes. That's exactly right. Yeah.
And then because the mining process and plus they run into a lot of water, how much effluent would be discharged from the mine?
Well, there are different sources of effluent. There's the wastewater from the processing system that would be discharged into the river. And, you know, that number has actually been revised at different times in this permitting. This permitting process has been going on for a couple of decades now. And the original estimate was 3 million gallons of water per day into the Clark Fork River. And I know that number has changed somewhat, but it's really kind of anyone's guess. It depends a lot on how much water that they actually encounter. There's a lot of factors, but you know, I think the main point, rather than the volume of water, is what that water is going to contain. And the wastewater treatment process will remove some of the nitrates and some of the metals, but there's still going to be a metals load that's going to go into the river and then downstream into Lake Pend'Oreille.
And this is, again, right on the edge of the Cabinet Mountains wilderness. Are there projected impacts on the wildlife in the wilderness?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, I could really cover a little bit more about the wildlife impacts when I talk about our litigation, because we do have an Endangered Species Act lawsuit. But there certainly will be it's industrial activity, so there's going to be a lot of disturbance. There are going to be miners, a large number of employees coming into the area that would be affecting the grizzly bear population with increased poaching. There's concern about the mountain goats, that the activity could disturb them. We have native fish, bull trout in particular, harlequin ducks that nest along the Rock Creek drainage that could be impacted as well. So there's definitely impacts on wildlife. And the main impacts on the wilderness, which we talked about a little bit about, is the potential draining of the wilderness lakes and also dewatering, because when they excavate the mine, water from those wilderness stream reaches and lakes is going to fill in into the mine cavity below. And so that's one of the biggest concerns. They've actually done hydrological modeling that shows they're going to be dewatering some wilderness streams for as much as 100 years or more. East Fork of Bull River is of concern, Rock Creek itself, and then some of the lakes like Cliff Lake and Moran Basin. So the dewatering is something that some of those streams may never recover. And, of course, that's an impact to fisheries.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about this tailings impoundment. What kind of technology is proposed?
Well, the tailings impoundment design is basically a 1990s plan that's unchanged from that time, and it's called a modified centerline. There are basically three types of construction. There's an upstream, downstream, and a modified and a centerline construction. Those three types. The upstream type of dam is the most dangerous, and it's the cheapest construction. It's the most prone to failure. In fact, we've been seeing here recently with the Mount Polly mine tailings collapse in British Columbia, the Samarco Dam and the Brumadinho Dam in Brazil. Those were all constructed using the upstream type of construction. It's the cheapest because they don't have to bring in as much material. They can just basically use the mine tailings to construct the dam. And the problem is with this, especially in a wet climate, some of those dams are prone to failure for several reasons. And one of the things I did want to mention is that they have already been banned in countries like Chile and Peru and Ecuador. So at Rock Creek, what they're planning on using is what they're calling a modified center line. And it's basically an upstream type of construction. Again, it's the cheapest and it's the most prone to failure. So that's one of the problems, is that they're using a type of construction that's been shown to be prone to failure. They're also using wet paste tailings that are partially saturated. And since we've had these major tailings dam collapses around the country, scientists and panels have been looking at ways to make these things safer. And one of the things that they've concluded is that mining companies should be using filtered or dry tailings. At Rock Creek, they're using what they call paste technology, but they're basically saturated tailings. The problem with those is that they are prone to liquefaction. So if you could sort of envision, the solids are sort of loosely packed. They touch each other so that they can help support the load of the tailings. But if there's disturbance from, for example, heavy rainfall or blasting or even an earthquake, the liquid in there moves so that these particles no longer touch each other. And what can happen then is the water becomes so pressurized that the particles come apart. And we have liquefaction, which you can imagine is basically a slippage of these tailings. So here at Rock Creek, we're using they're proposing an unsafe construction method. And they have wet tailings. And the other problem is they're supposed to do what's called a seismic safety analysis. And under Montana law, they have to use a 10,000-year event for their seismic safety calculations. And at Rock Creek, they've used a 2,500-year earthquake event. So that's an additional problem. And then finally, at Rock Creek, there's a layer of clay at the dam location. And there have been landslides that have been documented down gradient from where the tailings impoundment would be located. So if you look at all those factors in combination, we're looking at a very unsafe tailings dam.
Hmm. Okay. Anything else? Let's bring John in. The concern, I think, specifically for Sandpoint folks is the potential to add a substantial amount of pollution to the lake. John, as somebody that's lived around Sandpoint for a gazillion years, very involved in the community, what are your specific concerns about the mine?
Well, I think, you know, downstream pollution is probably the number one. I mean, you know I moved here for the clean water and the wilderness and what those things offer. And, you know, basically we live in a tourism economy, even with the virus going on right now, we're still in a tourist economy. And, you know, we count on our clean lake really for our livelihoods. I mean, that's, you know, I have a cabinet and furniture business, and it's mostly people moving here and second homeowners that are my clientele. And without a clean lake, my business goes away and my livelihood dries up. So I get super concerned about that. And, you know, the original estimate of 3 million gallons a day is just outrageous when you think about that. And we haven't talked about the diffuser pipe, and I don't know if that's still in the works or not, but originally they were going to diffuse that waste in a pipe that went all the way across 300 feet across the river, and there would be perforated holes every 2 feet out of this pipe that would diffuse the pollution to meet standards. And that just doesn't seem appropriate for, mitigating pollution, just diffusing it across the length of the river to hit regulation. So, I mean, it's a water quality issue for me. I'm also a, you know, fly fisherman and love high mountain lakes and wilderness. And, it just seems like the wrong place, you know, for this project, at least how it's proposed at this moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to pose a couple of questions that people that support the proposed mine would put forth as arguments for it. And I suppose the primary one is that it would create a bunch of jobs. Hecla, the company that owns the resource and is going to develop it, if they get the approval, says it will provide more than 300 full-time jobs. So what is the offset to that as far as the Rock Creek Alliance is concerned?
Well, my feeling is that 300 jobs is not much to basically degrade, you know, a whole ecosystem. I just don't think that that's a fair use of our, you know, national resources for the overall good of the general public. And you look at how many jobs are in Sandpoint and that count on clean water and clean, you know, a clean environment. 300 jobs for 30 years is just not worth it by any means. So it seems obvious to me, but you know, I understand that, you know, a good paying job for somebody up here for 30 years could really mean a big difference for a family. But when you look at the overall amount of families here, I don't think it weighs out evenly.
So that's an interesting number you put out there, the 30 years. Mary, maybe you can address this. The mine would be played out in 30 years. Is that correct?
Assuming, I mean, it could be, well, a couple different scenarios. That's sort of their estimate of how long it would take. But, you know, if they find more ore and they want to enlarge the operation, that would be a possibility. Or they may find that there are issues that cause them to stop mining early. For example, at the Troy mine, they had cave-ins, and so before they really were done mining out the whole ore body, they had to shut the mine down. You know, and obviously metals prices can really have an influence on whether a mine remains open or not. Fluctuating metals prices and the market, there's all kinds of things that could influence that. So really that's just an estimate. And, you know, I think John really framed this in the perfect way. And I would add to that, a lot of these that we're talking about are not jobs for locals, even in Sanders County, because there aren't a lot of people that are trained to do that type of underground mining work. And so they would basically, the mine would be bringing in people to the area from outside of Montana. And, you know, oftentimes we see sort of the classic boom and bust after the mine is done. You know, that has been sort of the economic focus at the expense of everything else. And then the area goes into that sort of that bust cycle. Mm-hmm. So these are really short-term jobs when you look at the broader picture.
And the obvious question, I think, is so what happens to the tailings which remain, you know, long after the 30, 35 years that there might be jobs created by the mine?
Well, that's what I was going to bring up is, you know, that you go through a whole cycle of the mine and you know, it's getting monitored and watched closely and then the mine's done and the pollution continues forever. We don't have to look far to see the pollution down in the Silver Valley. They're still dealing with that. You can't eat fish out of those bodies of water down there. Trees don't grow still there. You know, and I've been very involved in the mining outside of Cook City and Yellowstone as well. And, you know, that was mined way back at the turn of the century. And it's just finally starting to grow trees in some of those areas and the water quality starting to come back. But, I mean, we're talking, you know, 100 years ago. Yeah, so that's the real scary part is what happens, you know, and then the taxpayers are left to clean it up, and that's happened time and time mm-hmm. again. And I don't see a good example out there, you know, show me a mine like this that's worked and is, you know, is working. There's just not really any examples out there of a well-run mine yet, unfortunately, that I'm aware of.
Okay, so I think we've kind of framed up what the mine is about and what the proposal is about. Mary, why don't you bring us up to speed on, there's been some litigation underway that the Rock Creek Mine's been involved in. I mean, the Rock Creek Alliance has been involved in. Some of it's pretty significant. You have one case, I think, is before the Montana Supreme Court. Why don't you fill us in on the current status of this?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And actually what John said is kind of a nice introduction for one of our cases, which is basically it's a bad actor case. So Montana has a law that says if a company or an individual has left a mining mess in Montana, they can't open up another mine until they've cleaned up that mess, which makes perfect sense. So we discovered that Phillips Baker, who is Hecla Mining Company's CEO, was the chief financial officer of Pegasus Gold up until the time that that company went bankrupt in 1998. And the bankruptcy left millions in liability for taxpayers at four mines in Montana, notably the Zorman-Landusky mines, and then the Beale Mountain and Basin Creek mines. And cleanup at the Zorman-Landusky mine alone has cost taxpayers over $74 million. So this is another one of those mines that has acid mine drainage, perpetually polluting, and this is going to be with us for a very long time. So our coalition of groups that are involved in the litigation, we alerted DEQ, Montana DEQ, to Phillips Baker's involvement in Pegasus Gold. And subsequently, the state agency sent an enforcement letter to the company, to Hecla Mining, and to Phillips Baker, saying, you know, you need to clean up the mess and plus interest before you can open up a new mine. Phillips Baker and the company, of course, disavowed any responsibility, and they sued Montana DEQ. DEQ countersued, and then we intervened on their behalf. The case was heard in state court in Helena, and we received a favorable ruling was late 2019, in which the court dismissed Hecla's motion for a preliminary injunction against DEQ. Since that time, Hecla has gone back to the state court and have asked the judge for a change of venue because they don't want their case heard in Helena. And Helena was chosen because that's where DEQ is headquartered. They want it changed to a Libby, Montana court because I think they feel they'll get a more favorable hearing, a more favorable judge. And they also want to dismiss DEQ's complaint against them. Oral argument was actually made in April of 2019, so it's been over a year, and at this point we are still waiting on a ruling from this Montana State Court out of Helena. So that's the bad actor case in a nutshell.
Okay.
And again, it's what John was talking about, you know, sort of the legacy of pollution with these mines and companies that come in and go bankrupt and reform under a new name and want to come back and do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a second suit that's you're seeking to have the regulators ensure compliance with the Endangered Species Act.
Yes. Yeah, that's our Endangered Species Act case, which is challenging the Fish and Wildlife Service's biological opinion for both grizzly bear and bull trout, and at the same time, the Forest Service's authorization. They issued a record of decision in 2018 permitting the first phase of the mine without reinitiating consultation, which we feel that they should do. And just to sort of frame this up, because this issue's been going on for so long, the first biological opinions for the Rock Creek Mine were issued in 2000. So that's 20 years ago. And subsequent to that, we had one in 2003, a third one in 2006, and then we had supplemental opinions in 2007 and 2017. And the reason there have been so many is because there's been a series of litigation, and also things have changed over the landscape for these species, and also there's been sort of new data that's come to light, and so whenever there's something that's changed, the Fish and Wildlife Service has to go in and look at that. So there really are two sort of significant developments that have occurred since the last time we were in court challenging the biological opinion, which was in 2010. So one of those things, in order to rationalize their decision to issue a non-jeopardy opinion for grizzly bears, the Fish and Wildlife Service came up with some mitigation measures that they're relying on to mitigate the mine's mortality risk to grizzly bears. And those risks, is mostly human-caused mortality that would occur because there's going to be so many more people, miners and their families, coming into the area. So what they did is they hired a bear management specialist that started back in 2007 with these conflict reduction measures, teaching people how to live in bear country, keeping their garbage secure, that type of thing. But over the last decade, even with this conflict reduction strategy and without a mine, the number of grizzly bear killings in the Cabinet Yak ecosystem continue to increase. So that really says that the mitigation measures that they're relying on to safeguard this small population of grizzly bears is not going to work. And they need to go back and address that and look at that issue. So the other thing that was not done in previous opinions is they really didn't look at this hydrological modeling that shows that there's going to be permanent harm from the mine because of the drainage of these wilderness streams in which bull trout depend upon. They didn't do this hydrological analysis early on, but they did do it for the Montanore mine, which is another proposed mine underneath the cabinets, and they found significant dewatering. And so when they went in and did that same type of modeling on Rock Creek, and this is the proponent's modeling, they showed this drastic dewatering. So the Fish and Wildlife Service had to go back and look at that, and they actually admit it's going to reduce base flows in these streams. It's going to introduce harmful sediment. Streams, I think I've mentioned them before, like the East Fork of Bull River and Rock Creek, which are critical for bull trout, are going to be dewatered for hundreds of years. But unfortunately, instead of really considering these impacts, what the Fish and Wildlife Service did is they reclassified this population of bull trout that are at risk. When they did their early biological opinions, they looked at the lower Clark Fork River core area. A core area is basically a unit of recovery under the Endangered Species Act. So now what they've done is they're considering these populations as part of a larger, more robust population that they're calling the Lake Ponderay core area. So they're saying because they're really not part of this lower Clark Fork River core area, but this Lake Ponderay core area, losing these populations, having them impacted, would be negligible. So they've just sort of not really addressed the impacts. They've kind of ignored them and sort of, you know, tried to downplay them by reclassifying this population. So that's one of the issues. And I should also mention, of course, as your listeners know, the Cabinet Gorge Dam is a pretty effective barrier to fish migration. So we have these fish in the lower Clark Fork River, that aren't migrating between there and Lake Ponderay as they historically did. The other thing, and this is kind of the final thing with the bull trout biological opinion, is whenever the service decides that a project is not going to jeopardize a population, they're supposed to do what's called an incidental take statement, which is basically an authorization for the killing of a listed species. And what that statement does, it's important because it helps safeguard these populations because it basically ensures that if the take happens, it really is incidental. And it also, you know, puts a cap on how many fish or how many, you know, threatened or endangered species can be killed under that incidental take statement, which is important. And if they find that it exceeds what they originally anticipated, they can go back in and reinitiate consultation. For whatever reason, they did not issue that incidental take statement. And so that is part of our legal challenge to the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Forest Service under that case.
Okay, so this case is in the U.S. District Court, and when do you expect a ruling on it?
I don't know if it'll take as long as the bad actor case has been, but the opening summary judgment brief was just filed in June. So given that, you know, that was just filed, I would, my guess would be we probably won't see anything until next year.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In this case.
And there is a third case that involves water rights. Can you tell us
yes.
more about that one?
Yeah, a little background on this. In 2018, prior to that, the Montana's Department of Natural Resources and Conservation, their DNRC, they issued a water use permit for the mine. And we were actually hoping that the Forest Service would file water rights claims in Rock Creek, and they neglected to do that. And so the company filed for a water use permit for water rights, and that went before the DNRC. And we were unsuccessful in convincing them that this is not your ordinary situation involving water rights, because we have wilderness waters that are going to be impacted. As I mentioned before, this groundwater pumping that the company is going to do is going to dewater permanently some of the streams in the wilderness. And because they're in the wilderness, they're classified as outstanding resource waters. So under Montana water quality law, outstanding resource waters are protected from degradation, and that includes water depletion, not just discharges of pollutants. So we challenged this in 2008 at State District Court in Helena, and the judge agreed with us, and he vacated the water right that would be needed for basically the second phase of the mine. That decision was in spring of 2019. Basically, he agreed that they had failed to consider the fact that this water really isn't legally available because of the dewatering. So HECLA and DNRC appealed this ruling to the Montana Supreme Court. And interestingly, oral argument just happened here a couple of weeks ago. And during that argument, which I was able to listen in on, a lot of those arguments are being done, of course, by video because of COVID. So DNRC's attorney, they presented their argument, and they basically felt that they shouldn't have to consider the outstanding resource water protection under the Water Quality Act, because they deal with water rights under the Montana's Water Use Act. And so they don't feel that they should have to worry about degradation. And then the company basically argued that the mine's still going through the review process, so degradation is something that can be considered later. But our legal counsel basically pointed out to the Supreme Court justices that once water rights are issued, it's too late for the state to go back and do what's called a non-degradation review, which would basically look at that degradation of outstanding resource waters. So there's no permitting process in the future that could undo the damage once DNRC issues that water rights. So, in a nutshell, we're arguing that the water is not legally available because it violates that non-degradation provision that protects those water. And DNRC, it's not something that they're accustomed to looking at, but this is an unusual situation. And, hopefully our attorneys were able to convince the court that that the state agency should be looking at legal availability. They should be looking at water rights as well as the protection of outstanding resource waters. So, again, that was just heard a couple weeks ago. How long it's going to take the Supreme Court to reach a decision, I don't know, but it's always longer than you might anticipate. So that could be another year as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what is the upshot of the potential for these cases to actually prevent the mine, or if you don't prevent the mine from happening, what kinds of, environmental mitigations might you win?
Well, I talked at great length, maybe a little bit too much, about the tailings impoundment, and unfortunately, the time for changing a lot of those things, without the will of the DEQ to go in and really make sure that the company is using best available technology, You know, I don't see really that happening, and that's why we've really been focused on trying to stop this thing, because trying to make it a better mine isn't going to happen. And as John alluded to, it's all about location. You know, being upstream from Lake Pend'Oreille and underneath the wilderness, where there are threatened species, it's the wrong place for this mine. You know, the problem is the Forest Service has already issued a permit for Phase One. Our understanding is, you know, probably nothing is going to happen on the ground this year, but because we do have litigation ongoing, if the company were, you know, to try to go in and turn ground, I think at that point we would be forced to seek a preliminary injunction. If we win in a bad actor case, you know, the company's either going to have to come up with the money or they're going to have to get rid of Phillips Baker. You know, those are the only ways I, you know, if we get a favorable decision on that, that they could move forward. It would be very difficult, impossible really without water rights, I think, for them to move forward. The ESA case, you know, as I said, we've had multiple biological opinions. So the remedy there, if we win that case and the biological opinion is rescinded, you know, as what often happens is, they go back, the Fish and Wildlife Service goes back to the drawing board and they try to come up with other mitigation measures that will make, you know, that they can then, you know, issue a new biological opinion where they've, you know, quote unquote, fixed things. So, you know, our goal has always been, you know, to continue to delay this and fight it in court. And, you know, hopefully at some point in the future there might be, you know, a political landscape where we could make this thing go away. But unfortunately, the minerals are there, and we have the 1872 mining law, which, you know, could be a whole other hour-long discussion about that. But, you know, I guess all I can really say is we've been fighting this for over two decades, and there's no mine yet. And so I think the message is, you know, it's not a done deal, but, you know, it's still a challenge because things are stacked against us. And so, you know, we're fortunate that we have, you know, great attorneys. And right now we have some good laws on the books in Montana, and hopefully those will stay. So, you know, I remain an optimist that we'll continue to prevail in court and keep this thing from moving forward. But, you know, as far as a silver bullet, I'm not really sure what that is. But, you know, we're continuing to do everything we can legally.
Okay. Well, we have a few minutes left, and I'd want to swing the conversation back around to, you know, who and what the Rock Creek Alliance is and how people can get involved with it. John, when did you first get involved with the Rock Creek Alliance, and what do you see are critical needs for the organization?
Well, I actually was first involved I think before it was called Rock Creek Alliance. I can't remember. Mary could help me with what it was. What was it called originally, Mary?
Well, there was a Clark Fork Coalition had an office in Sandpoint.
Yeah.
And they were sort of the first group on board. So you might be thinking of them. And then, Cabinet Resource Group in Montana was also involved.
Yeah, Cabinet Resource Group. Well, my old rock and roll band played some benefits for, you know, the starting of this fight way back in, I guess it was 1996 or somewhere in there. So I've been involved from the beginning. But yeah, as you bring up, you know, we need members. So, I mean, I guess first we could point people to our website, which is rockcreekalliance.org. And there's a lot of great information about everything from, you know, how to get involved to, you know, the issue. You know, where it is. There's some interactive maps so you can kind of see where it is in relation to Lake Pend'Oreille and the Clark Fork River. But, you know, I think, you know, there's a little bullet list of, you know, what you can do to get involved. And I think, you know, the first thing is join. We need members. Second is, you know, write your representatives in Idaho, and also write representatives in Montana as well. You know, senators and governors. And our representatives up here, and then letters to the editor is always a great way to get some discussion going on about this issue. And I mean, I think it's a great thing to talk about. And I don't think this is a political, I don't believe this is a political issue as much as it could be made into that. But I think clean water, you know, goes right. I think everybody up here, no matter what your party is or your political leaning, I think everybody that lives up in this area is wants a clean lake and clean water and a clean environment. And that's why we're all drawn to this area. So I think it's really important that we all come together as a people on this, and that we don't want to get divided over this issue, because it really is just such a strong thing to actually, that we can all believe in, you know, our lake and our clean water up here. And then I guess, you know, one of the most important pieces is to donate. These court fights aren't cheap. And with, you know, the COVID pandemic going on right now, you know, we're not seeing the strong donations that we were before. So right now, if you do have the means to donate, and this issue is ringing a bell with you and you're concerned, money is probably one of the best ways that you can help the cause, the fight, because it's really in the courts, as Mary has been pointing out, that we've been keeping this thing at bay. And then we're also looking for volunteers. As we were talking before the interview, we need help with our website. We need help with our Instagram and our Facebook. So if you have skills in those areas, we would love you to jump on board and get involved. I'd love to see more younger folks get involved with this issue. I don't think a lot of the younger folks in the area know enough about it. But yeah, I think those are the five kind of things that are on our website, how to get involved. And yeah, I would encourage you to celebrate your clean water and join RCA.
Yeah, and again, that web address is rockcreekalliance.org. And I'm looking at it right now, actually. I think one thing, if folks are not acquainted with the issue, that's worth checking out is that interactive map you mentioned, because that gives you the visual. Oh, there's where the mine is, and you can mouse over it and click on information about the different things that are marked on the map. So rockcreekalliance.org is the website, and that's the way people would connect with you to get involved and to donate as well. So we're about out of time. I will turn it back over to you, Mary. Is there any closing sentiment you'd like to give folks?
I think John, you know, really summed it up well. And I do encourage people to, you know, get informed. And, you know, obviously folks can contact me directly if they have questions. You know, we've been doing this for a very long time. And the only reason we are still effective in this fight is because we've had community support all these years, and that's been a really key component. I thank everybody for listening, and encourage people to learn more and contact us if they have questions.
Okay. Well, Mary Costello and John Edwards with the Rock Creek Alliance, thank you both for speaking with us today.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. We sure appreciate the radio station and supporting the nonprofits. Thank you
okay.
so much.
Great. Thank you.
That's it for our show today. If you've just tuned in, you've been listening to Community Conversations on 88.5 KRFY and our discussion with Mary Costello and John Edwards of the Rock Creek Alliance about the group's efforts to prevent or lessen the impacts of the proposed Rock Creek mine that would be just upstream of Lake Ponderé. I'm Chris Bessler. Please be sure to tune in each Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. for more community conversations. If you happen to miss all or part of a show, remember, you can hear the recorded podcast on our website at www.krfy.org and click to our podcast page. Thank you for listening today.